I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
A Massachusetts High Court ruling today has removed the last obstacle to gay marriages beginning in the state, the first in the country, this May. The court was responding to an inquiry from the state Senate as to whether Vermont-style civil unions might be substituted for gay marriage. The court said no, ruling that only full equal marriage rights for gay couples and not civil unions is constitutional. The Supreme Judicial Court ruled last November that same-sex couples had a constitutional right to marry and gave the state 6 months to comply. Well, joining us on the line is Lawrence Tribe. He's professor of law at Harvard University. Professor, first of all, welcome.
Good to be with you.
And we should note you're a supporter of the gay marriage movement. You and other law school deans filed a brief with the Massachusetts High Court. What is your interpretation of today's ruling? Do you also see there's no other obstacle to gay marriages in May?
Absolutely none. It's as certain as the night following the day. It's very clear. The state's highest court has said that it's not just a matter of names. It's not only a semantic difference. It said that the whole point of refusing to call a same-sex couple married and insisting that they have a second-class status that might look the same but is deliberately denied full dignity is to relegate homosexual couples to second-class status, and that violates the equality principle.
Well, remind us again, what was the court responding to?
Responding to a request by the state Senate for an advisory opinion on whether the court's earlier decision back in November of last year, a decision which had said that it violates the state constitution to deny marriage to same-sex couples, whether that left any wiggle room for second-class status, although, of course, the state Senate didn't call it second-class, any wiggle room for the status of civil union, a Vermont-style status. I thought, as did the 89 other constitutional and legal historians who joined me in a friend of the court brief, that there really was no wiggle room. The whole principle of the earlier decision was equal means equal. Because some people thought there was ambiguity, the state was waiting for an answer to the question, which was answered unambiguously today by the state's highest court.
Well, the Massachusetts legislature was scheduled to meet next week to consider an amendment to make marriage legal only between a man and a woman. It was said that they would put off that vote if this decision came down in the way that it did. So is there anything that can be done legislatively?
Absolutely nothing. The state constitution clearly trumps any legislative move that might be taken, so that the only thing that could be done in Massachusetts is the rather onerous process of amending the Constitution, something that could not take effect until after the end of 2006, and something that I imagine may have a fair amount of momentum behind it, but that a lot of other people will come to think just doesn't make a lot of sense to do. Even if it's done, it must be remembered that the federal constitution, which the United States Supreme Court in the case of Lawrence versus Texas last year interpreted to mean that homosexual relations cannot be demeaned or denied equal respect, that the federal constitution would come into play. That is, if Massachusetts were to amend its constitution to say that same-sex couples must have some lesser status no matter what the nature of their commitment is.
Well, Professor,
that would be challenged under the federal constitution.
Right. Professor, it seems in the meantime, courts are going to have to scramble to get paperwork ready by May. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lawrence Tribe, professor of constitutional law at Harvard University. He spoke to us from Cambridge. Before he knew he'd won commanding victories in 5 of 7 states yesterday, Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry traveled to Washington State for the next round of primaries and caucuses. He told supporters there he's taking his campaign national.
Now we carry this campaign and the cause of a stronger, fairer, more prosperous America to all parts of our country.
Joining us on the line for a look at what happened yesterday and what's ahead, Larry Sabato, director of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia. Larry, hello.
Hello.
And John Kerry won in Delaware, Missouri, Arizona, New Mexico, and North Dakota last night. As the Washington Post puts it today, now comes the hard part. What is the hard part?
Well, I'm not sure I agree with that headline. I think the hard part was winning Iowa and New Hampshire as handily as he did, and also continuing that surge through February 3rd and winning five of the seven.
Well, and as we've seen, you can peak too soon. Talk to Howard Dean about that. And also, once you are definitely the front runner, there's a big target on you.
Well, that's true, but remember something. There's a big difference between Howard Dean, who was designated frontrunner by the polls and the press, and John Kerry, who the voters chose as frontrunner. Right now, John Kerry may have a target on his back, but he also has a Kevlar vest provided by the voters.
Well, Howard Dean is focusing on Washington State. Joe Lieberman is out of the running. John Edwards, Wesley Clark now turn to Tennessee and Virginia, where they feel they can do well. Is their job now just to wait for John Kerry to trip up, or are they still hitting on issues? They certainly can't be saying they're more electable anymore, can they?
The only one with any sizable chance of derailing John Kerry is John Edwards. The others are simply not serious candidates for the Democratic nomination.
Well, you know, Larry, this is the kind of punditry that voters hate, you know, because they feel as if it takes it out of their hands. Isn't there a chance that...
No, I disagree with you very strongly on that. It is the voters that creates this kind of punditry. They voted last night to give John Edwards a shot at John Kerry, and only John Edwards. In Oklahoma, Wesley Clark barely squeaked a victory over John Edwards with 30% of the vote. That hardly propels him into the front ranks of voters.
Well,
this is punditry driven by people's votes.
Well, as the candidates do head for this next round this weekend and then the round after that, what issues do you think that they'll be campaigning on? For instance, they're going to Washington State, to Tennessee. What will they be talking about?
They're going to be talking about their particular issues and their particular stance. For example, John Edwards is trying to position himself as Mr. Outside the Beltway to John Kerry being Mr. Inside the Beltway, Mr. Establishment. Whether that will take is another question. He's trying to portray himself as the average person's candidate, the son of a mill worker, versus the Brahmin candidate for Massachusetts, John Kerry.
In your opinion, do the issues still matter to voters, or is it a matter of, momentum producing momentum and it all being about electability and whether or not John Kerry or John Edwards can beat George Bush?
Here's the problem with the issues. The Democratic candidates mainly agree with one another. On 90%+ of the key issues, they are in agreement. Difficult to sustain a debate when you agree. That's why they're focusing on their personal histories. They're trying to connect personally with voters who, after all, share a Democratic Party identification with them. So that's all they can do at the moment, and they're trying to find a compelling personal story that will enable them to leapfrog John Kerry's substantial lead.
Larry, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Larry Sabato, director of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia.
Smear tactics. That's how an infuriated White House is branding a rising chorus of Democratic allegations about President Bush's military record during the Vietnam War. The president was in the Texas National Guard during Vietnam, but he's been accused of being AWOL, absent without leave, for a year toward the end of his 6 years assigned as a F-102 fighter pilot. We're joined now by Walter Robinson, editor of the investigative team of the Boston Globe. Welcome, Walter.
Good day.
Walter, let's review the allegations against President Bush. He was honorably discharged, and until the fifth year of his service, there are no allegations of dereliction of duty. In fact, Walter, the Globe study found pilots who served with Bush who considered him an excellent pilot. But then in May of 1972, Bush moves to Alabama to help in a Senate campaign. What happens then?
Well, at that point, and that was about 4 years into his six-year commitment, he stopped flying. He never flew after that date. He went to Alabama, and he was supposed to do his National Guard duty in Alabama, and the records are pretty clear that he did not do it. He said that he remembers serving at a unit in Montgomery both the commanding officer and the personnel officer of that unit said Bush never showed up. Then he supposedly returned in early 1973 to Houston to his unit, but in fact his commanding officers in May of 1973, one of whom was his friend, wrote in a report that they could not rate his performance for the prior 12 months because he had not been seen at the base. So we have a year's period where he apparently didn't show up.
Walter, are there records? What do the records show?
Well, there are records. In fact, there are substantial records to back up the fact that Bush had a lack of attendance problem for at least a year in the Air National Guard. Now, the problem is, you know, in the fog of politics, you have the Republicans on one side saying these are baseless, false charges, and on the other side, you have people like Michael Moore saying he's a deserter. And so, you know, it's an issue where the facts tend to get lost in the heat of the political rhetoric.
Walter, if there are records that show that then First Lieutenant Bush was absent for a year, why wasn't he absent without leave? Why wasn't he court-martialed?
Well, the answer to that is that the decisions to take those kinds of steps would have been made by his commanders. And as I said, one of them, at least one of them, was his friend. Bush, in his autobiography, describes his commanding officer as a friend. So nobody ever charged him with being absent without leave.
Walter, I don't want to put you on the spot, but as someone who's really examined this, would you conclude that he was absent without leave?
No, I would. What I would do is we reported the facts of the case twice prominently during the 2000 campaign, and that is that he leapfrogged over 500 other people in the waiting line to get into the Air National Guard because of family influence. He went to flight school, learned to fly a jet. He flew for 2 years, and even though he had, at that point, 2.5 years remaining on his commitment, he stopped flying and then did not appear for a year or more for his drills, and then was let out of the service 8 months early to go to business school. I mean, those are the facts, and if the candidates choose to discuss them, then I think it's a, you know, I'll leave it to others to interpret whether it ought to be an issue.
Walter Robinson is editor of the investigative team of the Boston Globe. Walter, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Just ahead, two writers go on the road to find out what Americans believe about God and why.
And later in the show, Utah legislators say no to the No Child Left Behind law.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
In search of what Americans believe about God and religion and heaven and hell, our next two guests, Peter Manso and Jeff Charlotte, hit the road from coast to coast for nearly a year. Their book, Killing the Buddha, A Heretic's Bible, is about what they found out and who they met, and it's also interwoven with takes on faith and doubt from several other writers. Peter Manso and Jeff Charlotte join me in the studio. Hi, Peter. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
So great to have both of you. Peter, just to start with you, Killing the Buddha, a Zen saying by a 9th century Chinese sage by the name of Lin Qi. What does the title mean?
This story goes that one of Lin Qi's monks, after years of meditation, had an experience of nirvana, of meeting the Buddha, of reaching enlightenment. And very excited about this, obviously, he ran and told his teacher and was dismayed to hear his teacher tell him that if that should happen again, in fact, he should kill the Buddha. He should be suspicious of what he finds and careful that it's not only what he's looking for.
Don't bow down before idols, Jeff. Why did you guys decide to rent a car? Buy a car, actually, for a dollar, I understand.
It's a great deal.
And try to find, were you trying to find God or religion or both, or are the two the same or not the same?
We weren't looking for God so much as the way people experience faith. We weren't looking for a true answer or this is the way.
So this was not a personal journey of discovery for you guys, finding yourselves asking the larger questions about the meaning of it all?
Not so much, though those questions did come up. What happened was 2 years ago, we started an online magazine with the same title and the same ethos, killingthebuddha.com. And as a result, we heard from people all over the country, all over the world, really, people who were struggling with faith in what seemed like a new and challenging way. And hearing these stories, we wanted to go out and find these people and record them all in a book.
The people you found are this cataclysm of characters, strippers and cowboys and everything in between. There's much doubt. There's some belief, but none of it traditional. And a kind of a darkness seems to hover over a lot of this book. Am I wrong, Jeff?
No, that's very true. There's an exuberance that we've encountered everywhere as well. But it comes from a place of real suffering. So that even when you see something that seems as absurd as a gathering of 2,000 naked pagans, and what drove them to that was indeed a lot of darkness and, in many cases, which brought them together, sometimes in communities that we could admire, some that tended to amplify that darkness.
This country has changed enormously in the past half century, hasn't it, Peter? Traditional religions don't appear much in this book, and in your experience, don't appear much, seemingly, in the lives of a lot of ordinary people.
A lot of these people live in the shadow of the traditions in which they were raised, which is to say that they have not forgotten them entirely, but they are sort of lurking on the outskirts of them. For example, in Los Angeles, California, where we met with Latino gang members who tattoo God under their bodies to protect themselves from bullets. In fact, many of their families would consider themselves very traditional Catholics. And so their response is a new response to traditional religion.
The traditional believers are out there in America, though. There's a Gallup poll from about a year ago. 60% of Americans identified themselves as some degree of evangelical Christian.
Well, the really fascinating thing that we found is that even these 60% of Americans who identify as such, their beliefs still run a gamut of the unexpected. In Texas, we met a group of people who call themselves cowboy Christians, clearly evangelical. And yet there is at the heart of their faith a kind of prairie environmentalism.
Not a lot of solace in this book. Am I wrong, Jeff?
Well, I think there is, and that's where the structure of the book comes in terms of alternating our true stories of religion in America from our journey on the road with asking other writers to take books of the Bible and to rewrite them, remake them, invert them, or pervert them, so however the Spirit so led them. And a lot of those stories ended up being surprising. Darcy Stenke tried to write about Song of Songs and look at the inherent violence in this central book, but the sort of the lovingness of it overwhelmed her, so to speak, and she ended up making a very beautiful book. Haven Kimmel, with her book of Revelation, ended up moving away from traditional Christianity and then finding a way of understanding what Revelation was.
You're both young guys. You're in your 20s. Is your generation different from a spiritual perspective than generations that went before it? I'm more of the generation of great transformations in religion, Vatican II, for example, the Beats and their Beat Buddhism. What's different about your generation?
That's a good question. You hear a lot about these days about America being a spiritual marketplace. And I think that some in our generation may respond to it that way. They feel they can pick and choose what they're trying to believe. But I think that they are also finding that, to a certain extent, where you've come from has a lot to do with the kinds of things that you're picking and choosing. And so if it is a spiritual marketplace, we are still being directed in traditional ways that we can't always see.
You guys come from very diverse places, the way you were brought up, one from a Jewish background, one from a Catholic background, right? Did your sense of your own faith or belief or spirituality change in the course of this year? Did it transform into something different?
I think I gathered a much larger palette for thinking about these things. I had been raised in a Catholic household and then had various other religious experiences through the years, but not the experience of being on the ground and meeting people on their own terms and really struggling with what they believe and why they believe it. I think much larger religiously now.
Jeff?
I've been thinking about this as we've been talking about the book. I'm the son of a Jewish father and raised in a virulently anti-Semitic town by a born Pentecostal mother who became sort of a Hindu Buddhist.
A true American.
True American. But I think the more important part of my religious education has always been the stories that we tell each other in religion. And by the end of the journey, I'd come to realize that my practice, in as much as I have a practice, is reading and writing stories about religion and talking to other people about these stories. I still go to churches and synagogues and temples because I'm interested in how people practice. But the religious experience can occur in the simple transaction with another person.
Killing the Buddha is the book. Peter Manso and Jeff Charlotte are the authors of the new book, Killing the Buddha, A Heretic's Bible. Peter and Jeff, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you
so much.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we take a look at one of the leading figures in Iraq, Ayatollah Ali Sistani.
And we preview the Grammys. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In his budget plan released this week, President Bush proposed eliminating or scaling back 128 different government programs, with more than a dozen of them related to education. But the president is calling for increases in his No Child Left Behind initiative. That could mean a lot of money for cash-strapped school systems. So why are lawmakers in Utah considering saying no to the No Child Left Behind money? Joining us on the line from Salt Lake City is Ronnie Lynn. She's the education reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. And Ronnie, this was big front-page news in Utah. What is the reasoning Utah legislators are giving for considering turning down the $103 million federal package?
Here in Utah, our lawmakers are a little bit leery of federal intrusion, and they see No Child Left Behind as quite a bit of federal intrusion in a domain that has traditionally been left to states.
The proposed bill that would turn down the funds, what's the status right now?
Well, it passed out of committee unanimously last week, and it's awaiting debate on the House floor.
Well, the No Child Left Behind program provides federal funding, but also in return requires testing and rankings of schools.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to hear in a moment from a Utah principal who supports the program. But outside of the states' rights issue, what other reasons are detractors giving for not liking the relationship?
Well, it hamstrings them in a lot of ways. Utah's demographics is changing pretty rapidly. We're seeing a pretty sizable increase in English learners and also the population of students with disabilities. Those two groups give educators here the most heartburn. They're expected to perform at the same levels and make the same kinds of gains as their peers that don't have those challenges. And, I hear from principals, teachers, administrators all the time. We want to be held accountable, but we're not sure this is a realistic expectation.
Yeah. What's been the federal reaction to the Utah plan?
Pretty cool.
Cool as in frosty. In fact, I hear a federal official is visiting this week.
Yes. We understand that Ron Tamales is going to be visiting and possibly some others from the Federal Education Department to meet with lawmakers who are sponsoring the bill.
Would this be a first in the nation if the Utah law passes?
My understanding is that other states have initiated resolutions, non-binding resolutions, sort of outlining their distaste for No Child Left Behind. But I understand from the National Conference of State Legislatures that it's the most aggressive step a state has taken against No Child Left Behind.
Well, Ronnie, thank you.
Thank you.
Ronnie Lin is education reporter for Utah's Salt Lake Tribune. Well, one of the schools that will be affected by the state proposal to reject the federal No Child Left Behind program is Lincoln Elementary in Salt Lake. Most of the students there are not native English speakers, and 86% of them live in poverty. The school relies on over $300,000 a year in federal funds to help students struggling to learn English. Joining us on the line is Lincoln School Principal Shannon Anderson. And Shannon, I understand that unlike your state legislators, you support No Child Left Behind, although with some reservations.
We think it needs to be tweaked and fixed, because the intent behind the legislation is good intent, and that is that the bottom 25% of our kids over the years have not been as carefully scrutinized in terms of their academic progress as the others sometimes. And that is our lowest kids who are living in poverty, who could be special education students or English as second language students, kids who are often overlooked by the system and fall through the cracks.
You know that opponents of No Child Left Behind say that that bottom 25% is targeted, that in fact the standards are set so that it makes it impossible for them to do well.
It's true. They don't have the right formulas to measure the growth of that 25%, and therein lies the problem.
In the meantime, you would, as you say, have that tweaked, but what is it about No Child Left Behind that you do like and that you would not want taken away?
What I like is that there is an accountability factor for all schools, that we can no longer overlook that bottom quartile of kids, that we need to be put pressure for accountability for those kids. The thing that we have to change is just to make the accountability fair.
What would you fear would happen if the state of Utah rejected the federal funds from No Child Left Behind?
Well, of course, the biggest, most obvious thing is we have to learn to live without that money, and that's a considerable amount of money for any school whose population is 60 to 70% poverty or more.
What does it pay for you?
For us, it pays for extra teachers and teacher assistants, both for ESL students and for regular students who are down in that bottom quartile.
And, you know, in reading about this, Shannon, it seemed to me that it's potentially a catch-22, that if your school doesn't participate in No Child Left Behind, you lose all of this money that can potentially tutor and give extra education to these mostly non-English-speaking kids.
Right.
If you do participate in No Child Left Behind, because of the strict testing standards of No Child Left Behind, your school will get a failing grade.
That's exactly right. We will be a failing school, and according to the legislation now, in the end, we will eventually be closed and our kids split up to other schools who seemingly are more successful.
When, in fact, the No Child Left Behind is what you're desperately using to try to get your kids up to the standard.
It's... Exactly. The children in our school do not have computers at home. Very few of them have books. Their parents are busy working one and two jobs and will not take them to the library on any regular basis. It is not fair to compare those kids with that limited background to the white, middle-class suburban kids who have all those things available to them.
And there are some grace periods built into No Child Left Behind. In your case, it would give you to, I think, 2012 to have the kids meet a certain standard. Why doesn't that work for you?
That doesn't work because we continue to get new kids, usually fresh from Mexico, from the countries who are sending us their refugees. We continue to get the tired, give us your tired, your poor. That's the population we will see.
Right.
We will have brand new kids every year. We can't possibly make those kind of gains.
Do you think the state of Utah will take up the slack of this, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, over $300,000 a year, to help kids like yours at Lincoln?
Absolutely not. We at Utah have a very young population. We have large families and a relatively small tax base, and our population does not want their taxes raised, so we will lose that money and we'll lose the services.
It's also a culture that is largely supportive of President Bush. I mean, it's a very Republican state.
We're a very Republican state, and if we're going to say we don't like that law, you know, what does that say for everyone else in the country?
Well, Shannon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Shannon Anderson, principal of Lincoln Elementary School in Salt Lake City, Utah.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397.
Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from.
Well, still to come, Elvis, Dylan, and the Beatles before they were superstars, and the photographers who took pictures of them way back then.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Protesters have been lining the street outside a Denton, Texas drugstore where a pharmacist refused to fill a rape victim's prescription for the morning after contraceptive pill. The pharmacist, who worked at a branch of the Eckerd chain, allegedly told the woman that the pill is designed to end life and that he could not abide by that. The pharmacist has since been disciplined. Here's Eckerd spokesperson Joan Gallagher.
Eckerd does not support a pharmacist's refusal to fill a prescription based on that pharmacist's personal beliefs, moral, ethical, political beliefs.
The Eckerd's pharmacy had not been the woman's first stop. Several other pharmacies reportedly told the rape victim that they did not stock the drug. She eventually had her prescription filled at a nearby Walgreens. Chris Lippincott is with the Texas Association Against Sexual Assault, a women's victims advocacy group in Austin. And Chris, can you tell us a little bit more about this case? How soon after the rape did the woman seek the emergency contraception?
Well, it's important for a sexual assault survivor to have access to emergency contraception typically within the first 72 hours. That's when the pill or series of pills are most effective.
Do we know where she was raped or anything about the rape?
No, there aren't a lot of details available publicly at this point in time about the sexual assault. It happened somewhere in the North Texas area. She is a resident of North Texas, and she sought medical attention in Denton, Texas.
Many people are astonished that she wasn't offered this emergency contraception right at the hospital.
Our organization recently conducted a survey of hospitals across the state of Texas and found that access to emergency contraception varies widely. Only 20% of hospitals offer emergency contraception as part of their standard care for female survivors of sexual violence. Another 23% offer to administer EC if the patient specifically requests it. There's a great deal of disparate care available for survivors of sexual violence when it comes to emergency contraception.
Right, and across the country, it's mandated by some states for hospitals to offer this, and that's obviously not the case in Texas. Well, can a pharmacist legally refuse to provide prescription medication to a patient with a prescription?
The regulators down here are saying that they cannot. Quite frankly, the rules are not as clear as we would like for them to be. Obviously, at the national level, there's a debate going on about whether or not to make emergency contraception available over the counter. The Food and Drug Administration is expected to rule on the over the counter status of emergency contraception sometime, hopefully, close to the end of this month.
As you hear of this story, this woman who had been raped, had been to the hospital, which verified that she had been raped, and now, you know, traipsing around trying to get a drugstore to help her. It's quite an image.
Well, it's troubling to us. Only 1 in 5 sexual assaults nationally is ever reported to law enforcement, and only about half of those rape victims receive any kind of medical attention. We obviously worry that negative experiences like this young woman had send the wrong message to rape victims. We want to make sure that they get the assistance that they need, whether it's from a hospital, from the law enforcement community, or from a sexual assault program. And again, ultimately this story ended up with a positive result that there was a pharmacy that stocked the medicine that was able to get it to her on time. Sexual violence is a tremendous trauma for people, and what's most important for a survivor as she or he pursues their own justice and healing is to make sure that they're getting support from friends, support from family, and support from the community. That means the medical community, the police, and society as a whole.
Chris, thank you.
Thank you.
Chris Lippincott is with the Texas Association Against Sexual Assault. He spoke to us from Austin. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Rock stars and photographers have always thrived in each other's company. A musician's fame, after all, isn't only about music. It's also about image. But before the image is fashioned, what's there? Well, a kind of raw charisma, judging by a new exhibition of photographs at the National Heritage Museum in Lexington, Massachusetts. Black and white photographs of Elvis Presley, the Beatles, and Bob Dylan before they all took the world by storm. The show's called Artist to Icon, and Hillary Anderson was our guide.
This exhibition is about early photographs of Elvis, Bob Dylan, and the Beatles from 1955 to 1965. They were taken by young, up-and-coming photographers who were at the start of their careers, and it's an exciting chance to see these photographers documenting these artists who we know so well now at the beginning of their careers as well.
Well, we're going to start with the man who started it all, Elvis. Here's a picture of Elvis in his living room with his shirt off, sitting in his socks. Tell us about it.
This photograph was taken by Alfred Wertheimer. He was a young photographer working in New York City. This was an assignment for RCA Victor Records. This is a picture of Elvis in that home where he grew up. And what they're listening to are the sample recording of the songs that Elvis had recorded the day before in New York City. He traveled all the way down from train back home, and one of the first things he did was have his family and friends listen to what he'd been doing in New York.
One thing I noticed, Hillary, are these kind of listening posts. What's that about, where people can put on headphones?
The Experience Music Project, who organized this show, put together interactive kiosks where the visitor can listen to some of the photographers describing the work and the situations surrounding these photographs.
We get down to Elvis's home, 1034 Audubon Drive. He's got his little mailbox with the flag on the sidewalk like every other human being. There's no gate, there's nothing. You know, you can walk right up on his lawn. Later on, he would come into the living room, and he's sitting there half naked with his bad skin. He had a boil on his back, but you think Elvis cared? He didn't say, stop, I want to put a shirt on. No. He's involved. He's always focused on what he's doing.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog. You cry all the time.
This photograph here, Elvis, he looks kind of exalted. He's in a room full of musicians. It's shot from behind the drummer, and he almost looks like he's singing gospel the way his arms are kind of outstretched, and he looks so full of joy there.
You're right. I think these photographs really capture him in the moment of making music. The photographer who was there the whole day did talk about how Elvis was really, even though he's a very young man, very much in control of the studio. He took 31 takes of one song that was recorded on this day to get it the way he wanted.
I had my technique of standing near the drummer so that I would be clicking away, even though they said, don't shoot while recordings are being done because we don't want your click. I was using Nikons, and Nikons did do a little click.
I don't want no other love, baby, it's just you I'm thinking of. Don't stop.
Hillary, we step into the Beatles room, and one of the first photographs you see is 5 Beatles, Hamburg, Germany, and the guy with the drumsticks and the little snare drum on the left is someone that we're not familiar with from the Beatles' fame and glory days, and the guy way over on the right with the guitar and the dark sunglasses, the only one wearing sunglasses, someone we're also not familiar with, and that would be the drummer Pete Best, their original drummer, and Stu Sutcliffe, one of their original guitarists and one of their greatest inspirations, and I think the boyfriend of the photographer, right?
That's right. This picture was taken by Astrid Kircher. At the time, she was just learning her craft, and she only used daylight, so she had to work a little bit to get them to be available in the daylight. They played in the clubs until 4 or 6 a.m.
I only used daylight then, so I took them to a place in Hamburg. It is used as a fairground. In the daytime, it wasn't open. It was very quiet there and very dirty and rusty. And when I saw this lorry, I just thought that's the right place to just let them sit down, and I worked it all out as far as the composition of the picture is concerned.
Hillary, this is a very kind of almost haunting picture, because the Paul McCartney in this picture is so young. He's got a fantastic sort of 1950s kind of rockabilly hairdo. Astrid, the photographer, was actually advising them a lot of on the hairdos and the clothes and the leather jackets and all.
Yes, you're right. She did offer them advice on those things. And then also another photographer in the area, Jürgen Wulmer, he also said that he helped them with their first haircuts that became so famous.
I had befriended the Beatles the previous year in a rock club called Kaiserkeller. I wore bohemian clothes and had my hair brushed forward. As I was one of the very few people in the audience who looked different, I had attracted the attention of the Beatles. One of the first things John Lennon had asked me was where I got my funny haircut. I cut it myself, I had answered. 6 months later, John and Paul visited me in Paris, as the two got only snobbish attitudes from the bohemian girls on the left bank. They wanted to change their image. They bought similar clothes as I wore and wanted to have my funny haircut too. So I cut their hair like mine, and that's how the mop top was born.
You just turned the corner here. We can walk into the Bob Dylan area, which is a different view of music. The photographs here were taken by Daniel Kramer. Unlike some of the other works that we've seen, these weren't done as an assignment. He saw Bob Dylan on television and was really impressed with him, and then spent a year trying to get an appointment with Bob Dylan so he could spend some time photographing him.
A gorgeous Daniel Kramer photograph here from behind, Bob Dylan singing, Joan Baez sitting beside him with her head bowed, listening to him.
I want to bring Joan Baez.
It's a wonderful photograph, and Dan Kramer has mentioned how it was a great opportunity lighting-wise that could have never been orchestrated.
At a concert in New Haven, he and Joan Baez were performing together, and at that time, I guess they were considered the king and the queen of folk music. I went back behind the stage, and another singer, Richard Farina, was there that night, and we were standing together and looking at this scene, and we were just marveling at this incredible moment. There were the strong lights coming from either side, a photographer's dream, because they were laid against the black background, and I was very fortunate to be there at that spot to make this picture.
No, 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 it ain't me, babe. It ain't me you're looking for, babe.
Well, to finish up, in this part of the gallery, we have a wonderful group of photographs that show a day in the life of a concert. They're getting ready in this one here, doing a sound check at Forest Hills Tennis Stadium. This is one of the early electric concerts.
This photograph was made at the Forest Hills concert in August of 65. The musicians were discussing the song list. Bob had an opportunity to talk to the players and kind of warn them that there might be an adverse reaction from the crowd. He took the position kind of the coach, and wanted the musicians not to be concerned about what the crowd might do in response to hearing the electric instruments. And he said, don't let that bother you. Don't do anything about it. You just go out and you just play. And whatever happens, happens. So you just forget about everything else.
Well, Hillary, thanks very much.
Well, thank you so much for coming. It's great to have you here.
You hand in your ticket.
Here now.
The Artist to Icon exhibit is at the National Heritage Museum, Robin, in Lexington, Massachusetts, until June 6th. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
And something is happening here, but you don't know what it is. Do you, Mr. Jones? You have many contacts among the lumberjacks to get you facts when someone attacks your imagination.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.